Welcome to Dialogue, a program that explores the world of ideas and issues in national and international affairs, history, and culture. I'm George Liston, C.A.
The old saying, you can't step into the same river twice, can well be applied to the history of ideas. When a culture calls forth old ideas and concepts, they are inevitably changed as they conform to the altered circumstances and usages of a new era. The belief in the dominant power of free market forces that was so central to American society in the early 19th century returned with vigor in the last decades of the 20th century. But the resurrection of market metaphors in the 1980s calls for close examination of both intentions and effects. For this revival has shaped not just economic theory, but the political, social, and cultural discourse that forms our image of society. My guest is Daniel Rogers, professor of history at Princeton University. Dan, welcome to Dialogue.
Thank you, George.
Dan, you are doing, to my mind, something wonderful, quite frankly, and that is focusing our attention on a decade that we lived through, but I think perhaps have not fully understood in terms of what it really, really amounted to and has done for us and to us. I refer, of course, to the 1980s, an era that saw a revived interest in free market forces. I attribute that, and we'll get to this in a moment, to a political crucible that was sort of forging things at that point. But the first question might be this to you, Dan, as a historian writing on it. How do you characterize the 1980s? I mean, do you see it, for example, as a serious battleground of ideas or just something we lived through?
Certainly it was a serious battleground of ideas. That was the code word among conservatives at that time. It's a lot of quoting of the famous Richard Weaver phrase, it's a war of ideas out there. Mm-hmm. It's what Peggy Noonan said. It's what Stockman said over at the Office of the Budget. It was a war of ideas, but I think it's wrong to think it was a war of ideas only on the part of conservatives. Mm-hmm. It was a moment when some of the key metaphors about with which Americans live, metaphors by which they define their country, were up for grabs.
Yeah, that's precisely why I find this so fascinating, because it goes beyond just the immediate circle of political theorists or scholars. It really is how the general public, I think, comes to think of itself or conceive of society. I mean, there's a wonderful quote of metaphors are not idle, they think for us. And I guess, what happens then, Dan? Maybe that's the next question. When this is introduced in the 1980s by conservative forces in this battleground of ideas and begins to affect public discourse, I mean, what changes in the way that, or to put it concisely, is there a change in public debate because of this introduction?
Absolutely. Though it seems to me that one of the things that we hunt for over and over again and hunt for wrong is to find what Americans believe. We're hunting always for the consensus line, mm-hmm. as if we had an average American whom we could put in 1930, 1950, 1980 and say, this is what Americans thought. Mm-hmm. The country's always been a battleground. From the very beginning, we've been engaged in a contest over these metaphors, over the words we live by. Mm-hmm. And we should never assume any piece of historical time to be more simple than the one we live in,
right.
which is as deeply contested mm-hmm. as any. So what an historian has to look for, it seems to me, is not the center, as it were, but to look at the array of forces, mm-hmm. who's standing in which corners of society, with what kinds of, how many are there in each corner? What are they arguing about? And over time, how does that configuration itself shift? Mm-hmm. So I don't see Ronald Reagan in even his role as most articulate of the communicators in our society speaking for the country. But what happened during the course of the 80s and the 70s, leading into the 80s, was to shift that configuration. So by the time we're done, mm-hmm. what stands for the center, what stands for conventional wisdom, the line around which the forces are arrayed had moved. It's very hard to, in fact, initially see how all these things line up, and they don't all line up. They start in different corners of our society. They cohere because our political system requires ultimately all these things to come into a presidential race. Mm-hmm. But they cohere more deeply than that, I think. We've talked a lot in the historical circles and journalistic circles about the 1960s. We're obsessed still by the 1960s. On the right, there's a sense that it was the moment when America just lost in its entire sanity, and all the rest of the work has been to bring it back to its senses. On the left, there's the sense of the world that almost came into being but failed to achieve its promise. That exaggerates, but if we think about the world, say, from 1960 itself into the oil crisis of 1973, it's a moment of both extraordinary shifts on the realm of values and family, and also it's a moment when there is a great confidence that you can re-manage the economy, do the micromanaging of economics that the economists had always talked about. The reaction in both cases, in some ways, was an attempt to find a world without the presence of force. What I mean by that is there's a very strong desire on the part of those interested in family values to return to things as they really are, where nobody's telling you how to be. The natural morality of human beings comes back. In the market, there's a sense that we're just returning to the way things naturally are. A restorationist mood that helps to hold these two ideas together.
Kind of a natural regulating function.
Exactly. Exactly.
It's interesting. I mean, I'm personally getting a wonderful sense of a lesson as I listen to you. And as I listen to you on this particular point, the first image that formed in my mind was clockwork. There was kind of a seeking, there's perhaps a perennial seeking after something that will naturally make us function as we ought without excessive force or intervention from outside. And wasn't, and we'll get to this in a minute too, Dan, in greater depth, but wasn't that actually the original idea of market forces? I mean, the early 19th century iteration, that was going to do it for our society?
Absolutely. It's Adam Smith called his system the natural system of economy. It's not an idle word. Though strong as the ideology of the market was in the early 19th century, we ought to remember that in fact it was not nearly as strong as we sometimes retrospectively imagine. This was the country of high tariff protectionism.
Right.
The Republican Party was the party of the protective tariff. Mm-hmm. Free trade is a very recent addition to American polity. It's the country that first in a big way promoted public schooling, precisely because it was thought that in order to have citizens who could work in a free society, they needed to be formed. They needed to be publicly formed for citizenship.
When you are, as you are working on the 1980s, Dan, have you confronted the question or been challenged with the question that the decade is just too close to us for this kind of judgment or not?
There is no doubt that among my fellow historians, there are few who would tackle the 1980s at this moment. Certainly, there's a great deal that we will not know until the archives are opened up. The inner institutional history of a recent decade is impossible to find. I think it's also true that it's hard to make recent history seem strange and unpredicted. What I mean by that is once you live through a time, it seems deeply inevitable. What happened must have happened because you were there at every single moment and you watched it unfold. It's easier to make things in medieval Europe seem unusual, make the outcome seem unpredicted. But still, by the time we're now in the beginning of the new millennium, the 1980s is a good ways back in our past. My students don't know anything about it when they come to college. Mm-hmm. It's time for historians to take at least a preliminary assessment of what it did to us.
Right. Well, I think you're quite on to something here. One thing that occurred to me as you described the first round of market ideology in America, free market radicalism, some have called it, is that in looking back, and I think I got the point that in looking back and reincorporating ideas in the past, perhaps there's some degree of romanticizing of them, that they're never quite what romanticize them.
We, of course, romanticize them. In some ways, being a nation is a collective project of trying to tell a story. And in the same way that we tell a family story by reworking it. Sometimes we rework it to exaggerate the difficulties. That aunt or that uncle or that parent that was really so difficult looms larger in the story than right. in life. But more often we romanticize by smoothing out the story, making the pastures more green, mm-hmm. etc. We do certainly this with the nation's history.
And in terms of the free market forces that were so important to the 19th century, you've already pointed out that that's a much more complex right. picture than we sometimes currently appreciate. But didn't that didn't the free markets? I'm clearly no economist, but I got the impression that the 19th century was in many ways a kind of progression of added regulation on that phenomena that changed it dramatically from, say, the early third of the century to its close.
Yes. I mean, I think we would like to say several things about 19th century economics. First, it's a society in which is essentially agrarian. Mm-hmm. Most Americans are still working in the farming economy until halfway through the century. It's in that sense a very, very different world in which we live in now. The cities are still relatively small. Immigration only gets going in a big way in the second half of the century. What we want to say about the late 19th century, on the other hand, is that we had a trial in many ways of a world with relatively limited regulation. Mm-hmm. And it was not a happy one. I think the historian's consensus here is very strong. And this is where we find ourselves often in a fight with economists whose understanding of the past only goes back to the 1930s. Mm-hmm. If you look at the world of 1900, a world without minimum wages, a world without child labor regulation, a world in which the sweatshop was the norm, a world in which joining a union would be grounds for being fired, mm-hmm. A world in which there were no labor bargaining rights, a world of deep, deep pervasive poverty, not only in the United States, but throughout the industrial world. When historians think of a world without regulation, this is our bottom right. line. All regulation is not necessarily good regulation. There's many, many examples that anyone can point to of efforts to move into this deeply exploitative world, which helped, and others which did not help. But the market itself in a world of industrial capitalism is a pretty fierce place.
Yeah, you know, let me risk a very personal feeling. I don't know if I can call it quite a thought, but it just seems to me that the market, for all of its power, really doesn't of itself exercise social conscience. It seems to me that there are problems it simply is not designed to address. And that, as you point out, regulation would be bad or good, but I would think, and I think you're speaking now largely the progressive era we moved into in the early 20th century, that was an effort to essentially correct some of the imbalances that unrestrained market forces might have caused.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. It seems to me that the wisdom on this question is to figure out what markets do well and what markets don't do well, and to figure out what kind of hybrid collections of public and political decision-making and private market-based decision-making really work for each individual problem, and where the level of attention to specifics is high, I think we often work very well.
Isn't that the crux of the situation right now, Dan, and quite frankly, one of the reasons why I think your work is going to be so welcome to us, that trying to determine, as you've just said, what markets do well and don't do well and how they should be handled is really, you know, at the core of things when we think of the wide variety of things society needs. But in the current instance, has the revival, and this goes back to the original reason for our conversation, the revival of the free market concept or ideal almost extended in the areas where it may be more problematic? I'm thinking that there's been an effect on schools. I mean, with the private sector emphasis has become, again, as a layperson, so strong to me in our society that perhaps it's affecting or trying to do things that need greater study or more
Absolutely.
Caution.
Mm-hmm. I think one can sort that out in two ways. There was first, starting in the 1970s, moving into the 1980s, a sense, an expansion of the idea of what markets could do. Mm-hmm. There was a great deal of talk about government failure. There were actual instances of government inefficiency, government cases where regulators overstepped their bounds. There were some striking examples of successful deregulation, though they often started in very particular circumstances like airlines, mm-hmm. Which turned out quite well by most accounting. But by the middle of the 1980s, one sees many things that had not been thought to be saleable now up for sale. The running of prisons, the running of schools, the selling of body sites for reproductive purposes. One could rent or buy sperm. One could rent or buy a woman to a mother. Surrogate motherhood was a great debate in the early 1980s. Right. This would have been inconceivable in the America of the 1950s. Yeah. There would have been a outrage on the part of all kinds of folks, philosophers, church people, citizens, politicians, saying some things are not for sale.
Yeah.
Some things stand outside the market. And we've expanded the range of things that we can imagine, yes, mm-hmm. they can be sold.
Well, this is an extraordinary conversation, if I say so myself. I'm learning as I converse with you, Dan Rogers. Let me take a moment away, though, just to say that this is Dialogue, a presentation of the Woodrow Wilson Center. I'm George Liston, CA, and my guest is Daniel Rogers, professor of history at Princeton University. And, Dan, I think we're moving to the point clearly where we have to bring the Reagan administration into our conversation. I mentioned earlier there's a political crucible to much of this, if not all of it, and it clearly has to be centered on that administration, that particular president. The irony to my mind, and I'm not making a political statement here, but I do believe that most would agree, and most, and I include his supporters, that he was a man of extraordinary rhetorical and political gifts, but I don't think many would say that he was an intellectual or a scholar or producer of ideas himself. So how does that administration begin to use the kind of forces you've just described mounting in the 70s?
Well, this is one of the most extraordinary stories of modern time, and I haven't worked it all out, and it's easy to oversimplify it, but one of the ways in which the Reagan administration clearly worked was that Reagan inspired so many people who worked for him to imagine what he thought, to imagine him as the man of their desires. Mm. And so they worked extremely hard to read the signals that he gave to them and to make a more consistent president than they actually had from experience.
He inspired their thoughts in that sense?
Exactly. Uh-huh. Exactly. His speechwriters imagined what he would have said, and he said it beautifully. Mm. They worked as an extraordinary team. Mm. But on economic grounds, it's clear that Reagan understood relatively little, and that may be charitable, of the sorts of economic decisions over which he presided at the very beginning of his administration. The David Stockman's reminiscences are full of the extraordinary anguish of a young man trying to get decisions out of an administration that refused to decide, that refused to make hard choices, and ended up with the deficit that we know so very well. But what Reagan stood for was a confidence in the ability of Americans to do whatever they wanted, the confidence of freedom to produce great things, and he helped to equate that with the realm of economic action. Mm. Now, he rarely talked about economics. In his State of the Union speeches, he would bring into the galleries certain citizens, those heroes in the balcony, you remember. And they were wonderful people in many regards. They'd done good things, had done voluntary service, they'd done heroic things. As I recall, one was a businessman. Mm. But there was a way in which the rhetoric of freedom and voluntary action became confused with the rhetoric of private incentives and the private market. And there were those who worked hard to make that conflation. And here I think of the very small group of people. We think of Jude Waninsky. We think of George Gilder. We think of Congressman Jack Kemp. We think of the Wall Street Journal. There was a small group that really framed that early tax cut policy.
The supply-siders,
mm-hmm. who were able to piggyback upon a dreaming president, a rhetoric of release, a rhetoric of freedom, and to make it work as a package deal.
I can see that connection, those connections working, because when I think of someone dreaming this situation, and of course basing it in prior reality, that agrarian America of the early 19th century must have seemed awfully appealing, with a kind of orderly process to society, everyone playing his or her part. And again, in this reinterpretation, principally dependent upon a wonderfully functioning private sector, and farmers selling their eggs at market, so to speak.
Right.
And then you just sort of replay that into the messier realities, perhaps, of the 1980s. And
yes.
And find support then in the academy and foundations and others for the message.
That's exactly true. And there was a certain way, too, in which Americans live in a deeply institutional society. Mm. They can't get to work without reliance upon the most extraordinary sorts of social institutions, to get the roads built, to get the snow shoveled, to get the buses to run, to get the traffic lights to work. We live in a world that is extremely complicated.
Right.
But we live in it, but we don't, oh, we'd like it so, We find ourselves frustrated by its imperfections, mm-hmm. and we imagine ourselves out of it. And so a promise of release, a promise of relief, to be able to go on a kind of road movie in our own mind,
right.
This still cuts a very strong and powerful swath through our imagination.
Yeah.
And one of the things that the 1980s conversation did was to bolster the connection between the forces of that hem in any modern society and government itself.
You know, all of this has survived. It went beyond the 80s. We're now sitting here in 2000, and what you've described is pretty much, to my mind at least, still with us in large measure, and if not entirely intact. You know, one of the things, Dan, that I wanted to ask you this from the moment I knew we were going to talk together. I wondered what kind of fuel has been added to this by the very success of the market. I mean, the fact that we've lived in this rather extraordinary circumstance of the stock market becoming what it's become to all of our lives, and America now sitting in this unprecedented position in terms of globalization and all of that. Has that kind of reinforced and said, you know, maybe you were right?
Right. It has. But yet I want to return, at the risk of complicating this, to what the word market means, because you ask the person in the street now, in the year 2000, tell me about the market. Mm. They know what you mean, and you mean the stock market. And they'll tell you it's doing, well, they'll tell you it was doing just great, and they have their hearts in their bottom of their shoes, hoping that it will continue to do just great. Mm. But market has not always meant this.
Exactly.
Even in, you remember the end of the 1970s when markets were doing extremely badly.
That's right.
Even the term the market wasn't used so much then. Markets in early modern world meant highly physical places. Outside D.C. here, spaces inside D.C., people would come and buy and sell, and there were special rules for those markets, special places you went to make transactions. Farmers markets are the remnant of this, and we still have a few, or those pieces of strip development where you can still go take your chances buying a used car in the market.
Right.
These are remnants of these old highly physical markets. But we have made an abstraction,
a global abstraction
out of the market. Mm-hmm. And now we have linked it in our minds, made a metaphorical hook to the stock market. And as long as the stock market booms, we think the market's doing well. Well, there are markets in other markets that are not doing as well. We might talk about the real wages, which for a long time did not reflect the stock market values. We might talk much more deeply about folks who are employed but not employed full-time. It's only at the end of a long stock market boom that we can imagine there's only one serious indicator of how markets are doing.
Dan, I'm sitting here thinking that you brought me right to the point where I wanted to ask you this question during the conclusion of our conversation, because I do want to have you talk a bit about these inequities and these things the market is not doing and perhaps society has to pay attention to. I've made a short list, which is at least a list of one person I offer this in a nonpartisan, just concern, curiosity, but I think our discussion of welfare in this society has clearly come to rest upon market forces, and some of the measures that have been taken, to my mind, have not address the problem which perhaps is no longer being examined, of what is happening to individuals in these circumstances. I think you just alluded to this, that we have the world's most acute wage disparity among industrialized countries. And that, to me, is an aspect of, quote, market that might merit study. I think we have an underlying class issue in our society that at some point is going to surface. All of this complicated by demographics. The country's going to be twice the size it is, I understand now, by the end of the next century, they say. A lot of this is going to be immigration fueled. Anyway, it's a changing world. And I'd love for you to conclude just by telling us what the problems may be and considering these factors against the market as, quote, abstraction and ideal.
Well, they're all very serious factors. We don't know how the welfare, quote, reform is going to work out. We know the incentives have changed, and that there are many more poor folk who are trying to get jobs. We have no idea yet, even in a very good empirical way, what kinds of jobs they have found, how long they're going to be able to keep at those jobs, what kind of life they're going to be able to make for themselves. Work is only healthy for us if it brings in an ability to live on the income that we earn. Otherwise, it's exploitation. And we need to think about those questions very, very seriously. I think, to turn the question around a different way, George, I think the danger, and this I would think of as one of the major legacies of the decade, but a warning, the danger is that we will imagine that the market has simply dictated these answers to us, that there is no choice, that if a CEO earns many, many times what a ordinary line worker earns, or a person boxing up the goods to be shipped or answering the queries over the telephone, we say that the market dictates his worth. Mm-hmm. That's an extraordinarily interesting answer. One might even say, if I could go out on the line, a rather un-American answer. We think we don't take dictation. We're not a fatalistic people. Yeah. But we have allowed a certain element of the natural, balancing, perfectly competitive market to distract us or to preclude us from also asking, is this the world we would like to make it?
Dan, I hope you're at work on a book on this.
I am.
Good. Very, very good. I look forward to it. I really do. And thank you so much for being with us on Dialogue today.
You're very welcome.
You have been listening to Dialogue. My guest today was Daniel Rogers, professor of history at Princeton University. I'm George Liston, CA, producer and host of Dialogue. Our associate producer is Karen Reed. Our technical director is John Tyler. And our production assistant is Andrea Bertone. Dialogue is presented by PRI, Public Radio International, and is a production of the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Established by Congress in 1968, the center is our nation's official and living memorial to the 28th President of the United States, Woodrow Wilson.
For cassettes or more information on Dialogue, call us at 303-823-8000. Contact us on America Online at radiodial. That's RADIODIAL at AOL.com. Visit our internet webpage at wwics.si.edu.